Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebelt. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Hello, hello.
Hey, what's up, man?
I just listened to an interview I did 2 weeks ago, and the audio is terrible. I've been having this problem for like 6 months, and hopefully I've got it sorted out at this point. I'm speaking into a large black box with styrofoam.
It sounds pretty good.
Well, so that's what's weird is people keep telling me that, and then I listen to the actual recording, and I'm like, fuck, it sounds terrible.
Well, the problem is with their editing, though. I'm going to mix this baby down so you sound like a star.
Baller. It's what I've always wanted.
Are you still in Vietnam, or did you go back to the States?
No, I've been in Austin for almost a year now.
In Austin?
Yep.
Wow, how do you like it?
I like it a lot. All the generic things are true. Like, the food's good. The nature's nice. It's a lot cheaper than New York and San Francisco. But, like, the thing for me is, like, the people here and, like, kind of the, at least for the U.S., like, there's, like, 15 cranes downtown. It's, like, the only city in the U.S. that's growing. That kind of pervades the ethos, in a sense. And, like, a lot of people who are just, like, interested in that vibe seem to come here. And it's not, it doesn't seem to be quite so, like, douchey. Try my new app, like San Francisco. So,
I see. So it's not that douchey app group, and it's not the hipster group from New York. There's none of that.
There's definitely a blend of both of those, but that doesn't seem to be like the primary. They're both those people I have met in Austin, but it doesn't seem to be like the primary thrust of it. I think a lot of other bootstrappers have recognized the same thing. Like, it's entrepreneurial, but not super expensive. So if you're like trying to find other people doing entrepreneurial things, but you don't want to drop 10 grand a month on living expenses, it's a nice blend of those two things.
What don't you like about Austin?
Compared to other places in the world, the weather is very subpar. Like, it gets blah in the winter and it gets super hot in the summer. The fall and spring are nice. I don't like owning a car. Like, the logistics of U.S. cities in general, like, you got to drive around, you got to drive to the gym. It's like, I've talked to people that try to do it without a car and it just doesn't work very well. Airport situation is terrible. Like, you have to fly through Dallas, or you have to fly. You basically have to connect. There's very few direct flights. So if you like travel a lot, that's definitely hurts.
Yeah, I want to get a balance because everyone's talking it up. I just want to make sure we also get the other part too. It's never all rainbows and unicorns.
No, yeah, there's definitely trade-offs. And it is, it's cheap by top tier US city standards, but it's still like it's at least $2,500 a month, even if you're like bootstrap, bare bones, rice and beans, don't drink. You're like still like, you're going to drop $1,000 a month in rent, almost guaranteed.
Yeah, last time I seen you were in Vietnam. So what caused the move?
I moved back to the U.S. originally. I was in San Diego for 6 months. I moved back originally because I was still working with Dan and Ian. I was running that valet parking software company. And I was doing a ton of inside sales and customer development over the phone. And I was working like 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. basically. In Vietnam, I just got really sick of it and felt like I could get way more done and be higher quality of life in San Diego. So I went to San Diego for 6 months and then found San Diego it's not very edgy. Like, I wouldn't say Austin's super edgy, but it's certainly more edgy than San Diego. San Diego's just like really laid back. There's like no grittiness to it and like didn't really feel like anyone was on the hustle. And then came to Austin in the middle of last year.
Are you still working for them?
I'm not. May of last year, we stopped formally working together.
Okay, so you stopped working with them and then you started writing a book called End of Jobs. Is that a coincidence or?
There was like a 3-month gap, but yeah, that's basically the timeline.
What made you want to write about that?
Have you read the book What Technology Wants by Kevin Kelly?
It sounds familiar.
Okay, so one of his premises in the book is basically like technology sort of like naturally evolves and like, you like see all these examples of like everyone files for a patent at the same time and then sues everyone else because they're like, he stole my idea. And his take on that is basically like, that's just the nature of technology. Like, all these certain resources and ideas are like in the ethos and like a bunch of like a few people grab them at it about the same time. And so I kind of felt like someone was going to write this book in the next 24 to 36 months. And I'd wanted to write a book, and I felt like, given kind of my platform and positioning at the time, this book would be a good book to write. So I picked it.
I've been reading a lot of stuff about artificial intelligence lately. And if it does happen the way, you know, people think it's going to happen, then yes, I can imagine the end of a lot of jobs. But did you come up with a solution, or is it just showing the problem?
So the title is kind of a misnomer, to be honest. It's not like the end of all jobs ever. It's basically the end of jobs as we typically think about them in a traditional industrial knowledge-based 20th century paradigm. So like the end of middle management might have been a more accurate title. But like if you are on this track where you basically show up and someone tells you what to do and you don't have any kind of creative innovation where you take ownership of projects and are like pushing things forward and like pushing the edges, like those kinds of like work as obligation roles are going to get eaten. But I think I'm sure there's still plenty and will continue to be plenty of jobs for people that are doing quote unquote entrepreneurial work, whether that's as actually the owner of an LLC or C Corp or whatever, or in a salaried or position with whatever small amounts of equity or however the model turns out.
Can you take me a little bit through the process of actually writing the book? Because I know it's a pretty big milestone to hit. You know, it's a big mountain that you see and you're like, am I going to be able to climb that thing?
What worked for me at least was just setting up hard deadlines and sticking to those. So I started writing it in Q4 of last year, so beginning of October of 2014. And then I just said alpha draft by the end of the year, beta draft by the end of Q1, and then final draft by the end of Q2. And because I was self-publishing it, I literally finished the final draft like 2 weeks before it went out. So I didn't have to go through like a lengthy publishing process. So I set out those deadlines and then just worked backwards to what had to get done in order to ship each of those things and had someone in place that held me accountable for those ship dates.
What was your daily routine like when writing?
I worked on the book, I would say on average 4 to 5 days a week. I'm a morning person, like that's my creative time. So I always worked on it first thing in the morning. And I actually blogged the book. So about I'd say roughly 50% of the book has appeared in some form on the blog. So some sections didn't, but a lot of sections did. So I was able to kind of overlap like building an audience for the book and actually writing the book by just writing it out on the blog. So I would like publish a post every Saturday morning, and I would have like the week to write that post, which eventually became a chapter or a section of a chapter in the final book.
Did you rewrite the chapters, or did you get them from the blog straight into the book?
I heavily edited them. I didn't rewrite them, but I had about 70 beta readers at the end of Q1 that went through, and they've all read, or most of them have read the final draft at this point, and they've all said it's significantly different. So I worked with an editor to rearrange that. I think if you've only ever written blog posts before, this was certainly true of me, there has to be a central narrative. So it can be your personal life story. It can be the life story of someone else. It can be a theme or a metaphor, but there has to be like something that ties the whole spine of the book together. And when it was written as blog posts, that didn't exist. So the final edit for me was a lot about just like going in and putting together this like central theme where everything loops back and references itself. And so I wasn't that final 3 months, the articles I were writing weren't articles that went in the book. They were unrelated.
One of the reasons I asked is Amazon does not allow publishing of anything that doesn't pass kind of their copyscape, right? So if you did copy the blog post, I'm curious how you got them through, because Amazon automatically says that, oh, you know, this book, there's too much content on the web, we can't release it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I had no idea they did that, to be honest. They probably went through 4 or 5 edits from the blog post to the actual book getting published. So I guess whatever happened in those edits was enough to make it original.
And you mentioned 70 beta readers. What was the plan? So it seems like while you were writing already, you were thinking about the audience and how you're going to market this.
I did. So I didn't at all in the alpha draft. The alpha draft I wrote basically as like a selfish creative experiment, which in some ways might have been good because the book is very much a scratch your own itch book. It's like, what would I go tell myself 5 years ago about how my worldview has changed? Like, how would I explain that to non-entrepreneurial Taylor in a way he would understand? But then from basically January until the book was published at the end of June, I was very focused around building an audience around it. And a big component of that was I took At the time, my audience was a few hundred people, let's say like 500 to 700 people, and sent them an email and said, look, I'm finished the draft of this book, and I was looking for beta readers, and 70 of them said, you know, I'd be interested in reading it. And I sent them a copy and had them go through it and give feedback. And like you said, one advantage of that is marketing, which is they all kind of have ownership in the book. A lot of the edits I made were based on their feedback. It wasn't just like good marketing in terms of giving them ownership. It like really substantially improved the quality of the final product.
I did skim through the book and I've noticed a lot of name dropping. So was some of the suggestions from the 70 people like, this would be better if my name was in the book, or?
All the beta readers are mentioned in the acknowledgements, but none of them are mentioned actually in the book. All the people I mentioned in the book were people I shot out and interviewed.
Okay. Did you think that by writing about so many people, that's going to help you marketing? Because obviously it's easier. You know, I mentioned you in this book. Maybe you can promote that, or did it just come naturally?
I mean, it was both. Like, to some extent, it was definitely calculated in terms of, like, this will be good for the marketing. But the other thing is a lot of people write books about themselves, right? Like, you use yourself as the central narrative. I talk about myself some in the book, but I'm certainly not the central protagonist by any means. I think for a lot of reasons, mainly which is the book is about entrepreneurship. And I would say my track record as an entrepreneur is mediocre at best. So I didn't think I would want it to rely on my credibility. Whereas if I could go out and interview people with very strong track records and use them to talk about the concepts. At that point, I was kind of positioning myself more as a thought leader and a researcher. I'm not saying I'm any good at this stuff, but here's some guys which are very definitively good at this stuff. And here's what they say, and here's how that fits with the ideas I'm explaining.
Yeah, you mentioned that the blog had about 500 to 700 readers before you even started writing the book. How did you get those readers? What kind of marketing did you do to get your blog to that level? Because I think for a lot of people, that's a pretty good number.
Yeah, so I think before I started writing the book, it had about 300. And then by the time I'd finished like the first 3 months of writing the articles on the site, it was up to about, 700. In terms of how I got the first readers, I started writing the actual blog maybe 4 years ago. Started as a travel blog and then slowly morphed into a business blog. And I was not strategic about the marketing until maybe a year ago, but it was kind of like a creative outlet. And it was also, for basically a year and a half, it was my like Saturday weekly reflection decompression ritual. I would just sit down and use it as like a way to articulate the things that I was working on that week and how I was thinking about them. And then I think all I did for the first 2 years was like I would just tweet it and put it on Facebook to friends. And then I had like a MailChimp opt-in box that I got with a free MailChimp account on the bottom. And that got me to a few hundred people over the course of maybe 2 to 3 years.
That's a pretty long time of writing every single week. So you did put some grind into this.
Yeah, I wasn't very strategic about the marketing at all until maybe a year ago. It was just a side project. It wasn't until a year ago I started taking it seriously as like this could be a business asset. But I think, you know, one thing to say about writing a book is I think if it's not something you naturally want to do, I don't think it's probably a very good project. Writing is very much how I think. It's something, you know, like when I woke up on Saturday mornings and I could do anything, it's like I wanted to go to the cafe and sit down and write for 3 hours. Like that was very much what I was naturally drawn to. And so it just became an extension of that kind of like natural inclination.
Why do you say people shouldn't write if that's not their inclination? Because then on the other hand, you have these guys like Tucker Max, which say, if you want to write a book, we'll do it for you, right? And just you slap your name on it. So why do you think that way?
I think most, this is certainly true in most corporations and most universities that I've seen or been a part of, is there's kind of this principle that you should like shore up your weaknesses, right? So it's like, oh, you know, John's not good at accounting, so let's put him in accounting for a little while so he figures it out. And at least from my observations of all the entrepreneurs I've talked to and from coaches, that's not a very effective strategy at all. That people tend to be different, which is a novel concept, and that you have different strengths and you're better off playing to those strengths. So I think like if you're a really good consultant and you know a book would help close you, you know, $100,000 consulting deals for you, like, yeah, go pay 20 grand and get someone to record you and turn it into a book. It makes a lot more sense than trying to write down and do something you don't want to be doing if it's just a business play.
Tell me a little bit about the marketing process of this book, because I I've seen you all over the web, so I know this was very calculated.
It was calculated. It did a lot better. I kind of calculated as big as I could, and it did better than I expected and continues to, which is great. The core, I guess the two kind of core principles I thought about with the marketing were, one, for lack of a better term, I'll call it Jesus marketing, but I thought a lot about how can I kind of create this core group of people who are passionate about the idea and who have a long relationship from reading the blog, and almost all of whom I've met in person that were in the core group, and thinking of ways to like empower them. So I would say like half my marketing strategy, my readers actually came up with and were like, send me this email. Like, have you thought about this when you're marketing the book? And then all of those people were obviously beta readers. And when the book came out, were very invested. And so like they shared it on social media. I used a service called Thunderclap, which lets you coordinate social media. You can like send everyone to it in advance. It will schedule a Facebook and or tweet to go out at the same time. So you can have, you know, you can send it to your 100 people and then you'll have 100 Facebook shares all go live at the same moment. So you said you saw me everywhere. I tried to create this kind of corner of the internet where I was omnipresent for a 2 to 3 week period of time during the book launch. And then the other thing is, as you said, like the people I interviewed, I reached back out to them and a lot of them had me on their podcast or let me write guest posts on their site and help promote the book.
You mentioned some of the ideas and strategies that the readers gave you. Can you go over a few of those? I'd be curious to hear.
Sure. So the main one was to run a book giveaway. So the book came out at the very end of June. June 30th, I soft launched it. And then July 1st, I did a big marketing push. But the second week of June, so about 3 weeks in advance, I ran a giveaway for 67 books on entrepreneurship. So the idea being, if you're interested in books on entrepreneurship, and I just published a book on entrepreneurship, I can build a list of those people relatively quickly by giving away exactly what it is I'm going to be selling in 3 weeks. And then because of that giveaway, I basically listed my 67 favorite books on entrepreneurship I've read over the last 4-ish years, and then reached out to all those authors to share that post, which then directed readers to the giveaway and basically let me, and I doubled my email list in the 3 weeks or 2 to 3 weeks leading up to the launch as a result of that. And that was an email one of the readers sent me that suggests, he was like, have you thought about doing a giveaway? And he like explained the concept to me. I was like, yes, great. And that was what I ended up doing.
Yeah, it seemed to me when I read it that everyone that subscribes gets 67 books.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was like, how is that possible? How is he giving away 67 books to every single person? I didn't get it.
I don't know. It was one person got the 67 books. I just drew the name last week. Maybe I should have made the copy clearer on the giveaway. I know it had one winner across the top, but probably could have made it bold or something.
Very cool. Yeah, because I think I see it in the book. It was on the third or fourth page, and it said, you know, resources and get your 67 books or something. And I was like, what?
I included the list as a resource. So you can like go see what the further reading list, basically.
Got it. Okay. I've seen you're doing really well on Amazon, and I think you hit the bestseller, which at this time, I think the Amazon bestseller is the one that counts. But are you thinking of publishing it regularly too? Maybe hit the New York Times and you know, become like a seriously respected author?
No, that's what I would like to do in the long run. I don't know a lot about the publishing world. I knew almost nothing when I got started and have learned a little bit as a result of the process. My understanding, I actually just spoke with an agent last weekend, is if you can sell 10,000 copies of a nonfiction business book in the first 3 months, agents and publishers will take you very, very seriously. So right now, my goal is to sell 10,000 copies in Q3. And then at that point, see what kind of, I don't understand very well the pros and cons of publishing. I think a lot of publishers don't want to republish the same book you already published, but you know, they'll take that as proof of you being a decent author and a decent marketer. And so they'll sign you for your next book. My understanding is basically, it's still worth going with a traditional publisher, if only for the distribution. They just give you access to outlets you can't otherwise reach, unless you're publishing the book, like you're actually trying to make money from the book. And I'm going to make some money from the book, but that wasn't my objective. It was very much to grow kind of my platform and reach and influence and readership. And then knowing I have to build out some sort of more sustainable back end to the business over the next year or two.
As a bestseller on Amazon, what's the average amount of books that you're actually doing per day? Just an average, not like an exact number. I think it'd be interesting for people to know what like a bestseller is selling, actually, in the number of books?
It's nonfiction business, which is not a very good in terms of like number of units sold. It's not a very good category. Let's see, I'm like top three in business, and then I've been number one in entrepreneurship and small business for about 2 weeks. And I say I'm averaging like 150 to 200 copies a day. Some days down below 100 and some days up above 300, but that's probably about the mean.
Yeah, so it's obviously really different than some of the fiction that's selling, but it's still respectable. And I think you can still hit the 10,000 within 3 months if you know things continue this way. So you said this is something that's going to build up the readership for your business. What is your business?
So right now my business is consulting. And my kind of three primary areas are digital marketing. It started out as e-commerce, which is my background. I used to run two e-commerce stores in the business-to-business hospitality industry. But it's kind of broadened to be more general digital marketing. Also do a lot of stuff around business systems, a la Sam Carpenter, Michael Gerber, Built to Sell, like how do you get yourself out of the day-to-day operations and scale the business. And then some stuff around personal habits and productivity. So I basically, at the beginning of the year, decided instead of trying to scale the consulting, I would just use the consulting, which is relatively leveraged, to invest in the book and the platform. And that continues to be my goal. I have a consulting page up. I don't actively market it. It's almost all referral driven. In fact, it is all referral driven. So the back end to the book, I still don't know what that looks like. And probably won't start working on it heavily until Q4 of this year at the earliest, maybe next year.
Before we wrap it up, since the book is called The End of Jobs, and this is kind of a touchy subject with other people, there's so many TV shows and stuff and other bloggers saying you should leave your job, jump into the business world. I really don't feel that most people will make it. How do you feel about it?
So the argument I would make is when I say the end of jobs, I mean the end of jobs under kind of this traditional paradigm of work is obligation. So if you're in a role where you're basically being told what to do, there's no level of innovation. You know, I think of like low-level bookkeepers, like those positions are going away. And part of what's happening is work is kind of shifting along this spectrum of simple and straightforward and best practices where you're trained exactly what to do and you're just following documentation. And it's moving down a continuum from best practices to good practices to emergent practices where you have to use a lot of creativity and innovation to try and figure things out. So if you think about it, like in chess is a good example, maybe the simple version of chess would be checkers. It's like very simple and basic how checkers plays out. And then complicated would be like you playing chess. So there's a lot of skill involved. There is some knowledge involved. But fundamentally, you can build a computer that's going to be able to play chess. And where work is starting to go is into this complex domain. So like imagine playing chess, except the other player isn't one person. It's each piece has its own sense of intelligence and can move whenever it wants to. So all of a sudden, like, there's no good practices anymore. This is very much like an emergent phenomenon where you're trying to figure things out. So exactly what the structure for that is, whether, you know, how people will be employed by companies, I don't know, but that's certainly the way the trend is going. And I generally feel my response to the argument that like some people won't be well suited to it is, one, it doesn't really matter. Like that's the way things are moving and whether or not people are suited to it, like the economy is moving that direction for structural reasons, kind of driven by technology. And then I do tend to be, I guess, a humanist, for lack of a better term. I think people are inherently creative and innovative, and many people have had that stifled or drilled out of them by aspects of the modern education system and aspects of the way traditional corporations frequently work, and they've been kind of told to put their heads down. But I don't think that's the natural human condition, and I'm very much an optimist in terms of what it means that we're coming to the end of jobs.
Well said. What's your favorite book this year? Because I know you read a lot, so I'm curious. Well, maybe two, like a fiction book and a nonfiction book. Give me your favorite.
Ones that I've read this year?
Yes, from this year. Something that's pretty new. Maybe people don't know about it.
I'll give you one. It's not new, but I suspect very few people know about it. It's called Certain to Win by Chet Richards. And it is, if anyone's familiar with John Boyd, he was an Air Force pilot and came up with this concept called the OODA loop. And basically, he figured out there was this fundamental shift in warfare that happened basically with the German Blitzkrieg. The short version being that warfare was much more driven by how fast you could move and much less driven by the size of your force. So like you see this like insurgencies, the people that can move fast and kind of operate in this, you know, going back to the chess metaphor, like all the pieces are moving around individually. It doesn't matter how big the other side is. If the piece has this kind of like networked intelligence, it can move quickly. So he studied under John Boyd, the author Chet Richards, and he basically distilled these concepts into the business world. So like if you're in business, this same shift is going on. And what are the implications of that and how do you adjust? And then favorite fiction. I don't read a lot of fiction, to be honest. Probably my favorite fiction book this year is I'm rereading The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series by Douglas Adams.
Okay.
Which is delightful and hilarious.
Awesome. If people want to reach out to you or just see what you're up to, where should they go?
You can come to my website. It's taylorpearson.me. It's Taylor as in Taylor Swift, Pearson, P-E-A-R-S-O-N. And then my email is taylor@taylorpearson.me. And my Twitter is ctaylormpearson. And I love to hang out on Twitter, so ping me.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the digital architect, Liebelt. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.